Hey, it's Joe. I remember many years ago reading that Bruce Lee said, "Patience is not passive, it is concentrated strength." I also remember not understanding what the hell he was talking about. Until now. The older athlete's greatest asset isn't strength or fitness, it's consistency. But consistency has two forces pulling it in different directions: motivation and avoiding injury. Push too hard and injury makes the decision for you. Plus, an athlete's intuition often makes it worse. Strength athletes think about getting stronger. Endurance athletes think about getting more miles. Mobility athletes think about getting more flexible. The thing that you love and want to be the answer isn't. The answer that never occurs to us is patience. Yet, the athlete who never gets injured always beats the one who trains harder but keeps breaking down. Today I'm talking to Jeremy Bettel. Jeremy holds a PhD in human performance as one of the most respected figures in applied athletic science. He founded Vitality Collective to take the principles he developed working with elite athletes and bringing them to the rest of us. If anyone can tell us how to stay consistent, stay healthy, and stop fighting our own instincts, it's him. All right, let's talk to Jeremy Bettel. Jeremy Bettel, welcome to the Wise Athletes Podcast.
Joe, thanks so much for having me on. What an honor to be invited.
Did I say your name right?
Yeah, that was pretty close.
Pretty close. Okay, tell us how is it pronounced? What's the right way? I'm sorry.
Jeremy Bettel.
All right, I got to get better at that. All right. Hey, man, here's what it says about you when I ask AI, who the heck are you? I know who
right.
you are, but anyway, for the audience's sake, it says you're a sports performance scientist and strength and conditioning expert known for your work with elite professional sports teams, as well as, and this is the interesting bit, your role in advancing performance science, both for team sports and everyday health. How would you describe who you are, what you do?
That's a decent description. Thanks, AI.
All right. Good for AI.
I spent a career, it would go back to my undergraduate. I studied sport and exercise science back in England and then moved to the States to go to grad school and got a master's and PhD in human performance. We studied the reactive elements of sport. So the cognitive aspects of how we make decisions and change direction in an uncertain environment. And then pretty quickly from that got into high performance sport. So strength and conditioning, it was the path that I took into it. I worked for USA Rugby. I worked in the NCAA. I spent some time in post rehab learning the whole mechanics around injury and rehab. And then my journey into professional sports started. So I was the head strength coach and director of nutrition for the Brooklyn Nets. Then I was the director of sports science and performance. I'd switched to hockey for the Toronto Maple Leafs. Wonderful experience up there in Canada. Built a great team. And we went 3.5 years without having a single injury, a preventable injury, I'll say.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, it was really good. Then we went, we needed a bit of sunshine. So I went and worked for the Anaheim Ducks for a couple of years and got them through COVID and all that mess. Then switched coast back to New York and went to soccer. So I was with New York City Football Club and we won MLS Cup while I was there.
Fantastic.
And then got out and decided it was time for something a bit different. I wanted to build something outside of sport. So we built this system that I had been building in sport for the teams, took a look at healthcare outside of sport and thought, well, this is terrible. Mm. We would never treat an athlete like this. So why don't we put this system that we just built for athletes with so much success and put this around regular people? And the results have just been phenomenal. So we're applying that pro sport model to the longevity space, but more than longevity, it's vitality. So our company's Vitality Collective, because it's not just enough to live as long as we can. We've heard a lot about health span, but even more than that, like, it's how do we squeeze every ounce out of it? And if you look at what pro athletes do, we have to perform at the absolute peak every single day. So you do whatever it takes to carry that day to day. And so we're applying that model of intelligent training, conscious nutrition, sleep, emotional, social, and spiritual connection. We're looking at optimal brain health, using medicine proactively rather than reactively in order to really optimize the system and have you do the activities you love doing for as long as you want to do them.
Well, that sounds great. I mean, that's right down our alley here with the Wise Athletes. We're talking about longevity in sport, right? How to be an athlete for a long life That's what you're saying. How do you push the boundary and stay vital? I like that word. Yes. I might have used that, vital athletes. Anyway, I came up with something else. But how do you push that boundary and slow or avoid that decline that seems to come naturally? We don't like it, yeah, and we want to minimize it or eliminate that. So awesome. So you're the right guy to have on the show. I'm glad to have you here.
Good.
And we can talk about anything that you think is relevant to my audience, which sounds like everything you do. The things that in particular that I have heard you talk about in the past, and I mm-hmm. want to make sure we cover here today, is your, you know, it's this whole kind of, you know, load management, injury prevention thing. And you've had a lot of success with that, right? Even in professional hockey, like no injuries. That's crazy.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, professional athletes are always on the edge because they're pushing so hard, because there's always somebody just as good, mm-hmm. if not better than them. And if they're not pushing the edge, well, they've already lost. So they've got to do it, but that makes them vulnerable to doing just a little bit too much at the wrong moment. And something happens and now they're injured and now they're really in trouble because they got to not only heal their, but now they're detraining and not getting experience. And anyway, but the older athlete kind of has a similar thing. It always seemed to me that not for the same reason, you know, I'm not trying to compete against anybody. I just do what I do. And I've been doing it for a long time, but my body's ability to be resilient and to recover is getting worse over time. Mm-hmm. And so I'm bumping up against this same sort of barrier of maybe doing a little too much that an elite athlete would at an entirely different level, but for a different reason. And so, you know, the most important thing that goes through my mind when I'm training is don't get hurt. Because an injury lasts for a long time and it totally wrecks everything that I'm trying to do. So, you know, one of the things for sure that I want to talk about is this business of how to avoid injuries. And it's, I've heard you say, it's not by doing too little, but it's also not by doing too much. And anyway, so I don't know, where should we start in you sharing your knowledge with us?
You know, I think what's really important to state are the similarities that you alluded to between the elite athlete and the high performer outside of sport. And the primary similarity is that they both have human bodies, right? That are no different. The outputs might look a little different, but it's a human who is taking part in a goal-based activity, right? There are structured demands. We can understand from a scientific point of view how hard the activity that we want to participate in is. What we can then also understand with the athlete is where that athlete currently sits with their capacities relative to the demands of their sport. So, Joe, when we get injured, it's because the demands of the activity far exceed the capacity of whichever tissue breaks down. So that's the key underlying principle to understand. And this could be from any aspect. This could be a force related thing. So, you know, if you're hiking and you jump down off a rock, that's a huge amount of force that you have to accept. So we can see an injury in the soft tissue there because we aren't capable of accepting that force. It could be velocity, right? So often a player would tear their groin in hockey, not because they were too weak, but because they didn't have the acceleration and they couldn't contract that adductor muscle quickly enough. And so they ended up with a tear in the groin. And also direction. If we only train front to back, and then we want to do an activity that's a little more reactive in nature, if we're playing pickleball, then, and we're not used to that pivot and that direction, then we might see an injury there. And so really it's about what exactly are we going to ask the body to do? And it doesn't matter if you're an NHL hockey player or if you're a master cyclist or pickleball player. We just have to understand what we're going to be asking of the body. So I think that's the key underlying principle that we need to dig into.
I think that makes sense. Let's do that. And I want to just see if it's okay if I add to what you said, because, you know, as a master's athlete, let's say I play pickleball. That is, I do have demands of my sport, but my demands of my body go beyond my sport. Because what I really want to do is I want to be a healthy person for a long time who can play pickleball as well as other things. And so maybe the pickleball in what it does is kind of got some extremes, and I could get injured there, and I have to be prepared for that. But I probably need my workout routine to do more for me than just prepare me for pickleball.
Yes and no, because in preparing for the most extreme demands, we cover the bases on basically everything else that happens.
Ah, okay.
And if you think about the demands of daily life, or let's apply this model to longevity, right? What are the things that are going to compromise our longevity? Well, it's the chronic diseases. We look at metabolic health, you know, things like diabetes. We look at dementia, Alzheimer's. We look at cardiovascular disease, things like osteoporosis. The most dangerous, I think, of all of the injuries, like a hip fracture from osteoporosis. So now we're looking at fall prevention. Now look at the demands of pickleball, right? It's a reactive sport. So that means the coordination between the brain, the object that's coming towards you, and the muscles that are going to have to fire in sequence in order to play that return shot. So we're putting huge demands on the brain. So tennis and pickleball are actually some of the best longevity activities we can take part in because of the brain health connection. Big metabolic demands on the brain. You think about every muscle that fires has to be coordinated by the brain. So we're getting a huge number of neurons and crossover networks within the brain to actually coordinate that whole body movement. So we've got our brain health covered off because we're playing that. We've got increased blood flow to the brain. We've got the, if you think about how we fall, we don't just stand there and fall over. We might trip, in which case you have to quickly get your leg out in front of you, and you have to have the quad strength to catch and decelerate. Well, that again looks like a lot like a return from a low ball in pickleball. So all of these skills that we're practicing for and training for are happening in that sport. Now, the mistake people make, and some pro athletes make this mistake too, is that they think the sport is enough. And that's where we see these injuries, because we can get away with that for a long time, where we can just go out and play pickleball, or we can just go out and ride our bike. But we actually need to start thinking more as we go into our 40s. We need to start thinking much more about how we're preparing for the demands of the sport, because that's where the injury can happen. If I'm running towards the net and I slam my foot into the ground for a hard stop, and I haven't trained my Achilles, my calf and Achilles, for that much force that quickly, I'm likely to tear my Achilles. And so that's where we need to incorporate some of these training modalities, our strength training, our plyometric training, our cardiovascular training, all of these things to prepare us so that fatigue doesn't set in and so that we don't put these huge forces through tissues that aren't prepared for them.
I mentioned pickleball because I don't actually play pickleball. What I do is, I think, more limited in what it trains me to do. And so when you talk about things in addition to pickleball, I'm thinking, oh yeah, because I'm just riding my bike and lifting weights in the gym. And I don't think riding my bike and doing bench press is training me for all of the things I need to do in my life as a human being who, in every other way, not cycling or weightlifting, is shriveling and disappearing. I'm going to need some of those things.
Yeah, absolutely. And so still, I think, if we're looking at cycling, you want to continue to perform really well in cycling, right? At some point, you might want to ride up a hill, right? And still be able to maintain pace. And so that's where your strength training for your lower body is critical. You must maintain the ability to apply force into the pedal. But repetitive sports like cycling, they will tend to bias certain muscle groups over and over again. Cycling will actually continuously put quite a good load through the thigh musculature, through the quadriceps. And so it's actually very good for leg strength. So your ability to get up and down off the ground as you age, as we look way off into the distance, is going to be a critical factor. So that's going to be great. But what we miss often in our training, and sometimes in sports like that, is what connects the upper body and the lower body. So we'll go to the gym and we might do upper body for a day, and that's everything here, right? Mm-hmm. And then we might go to the gym and do lower body, and we might sit on some machines and do some leg circuits or something like that. But what are we doing? How are we training like an athlete would think about moving in space and functioning in space? Essentially, what the core and the pelvis do is transfer force from the upper body to the lower body to the upper body, so that we can stay connected and stay injury free through our back, through our core, shoulders, everything else. So that's how we think about training for longevity. It's the exact same as we train for an athlete.
Okay.
How are we doing activities that create stress across the body, that we have to produce force in the lower body and transfer it up through the upper body? So these very applied, very functional movement patterns that incorporate more than just my chest and my triceps if I'm doing my bench press. These, I think, are really important things to take into account.
Yeah. So how do we get into some details on that? And I think that we have to talk about two things. One is sort of the range of things that we have to do that keeps all of the parts of our body working as well as working together. But also, if we have let it go, you know, like for me, I'm not doing a lot of stop, start or changing direction quickly. So if I haven't done that in 5 years or longer, then maybe there's like a progression where I can, you know, instead of going out and doing what I did 35 years ago, and now I have to go right to the emergency room, there's something I can do to start to make my tissues wake up and say, oh, we're going to be doing that again, are we? Okay.
Right. Yeah, 100%. And that's such a valuable point, particularly with a lot of the science communication that's coming out into the public forum right now around lifting heavy, jump training. You know, you're getting this stuff communicated out, particularly a lot focused at women who, you know, going into perimenopause, menopause, but I extend that across the board. We're communicating that, and it's wonderful that there's more awareness, but we're not doing, as you said, okay, how do we start that? Because there's some inherent dangers with jump training and with lifting heavy. Both are important, and yes, we need to do both of them. But let's put some definitions around exactly what that means. Because to the layperson, if I say you've got to lift heavy, you think about going and picking up the biggest weight that you can find, and you think, oh, that seems risky. I don't know if I should do that. Mm. What heavy actually means, what the research shows us, is that it's more about effort. So whether I'm lifting a weight that I can lift as heavy as I can for one repetition, which will be a heavy weight, or if I'm lifting as many as I can for 12 reps, we're going to see very similar benefits, but with very different risk profiles. Hmm. So I tend to work in the sort of 8 to 12 rep range with all of my clients who are 40s, 50s, 60s and up. We go all the way up to, I think my oldest clients are 85, 86. And she's a master's tennis player.
Nice.
The reason for that, it's not that I'm against people who, if someone comes to me and says, I want to improve my one rep max, great, I will help you do that, but it won't be today. We will be taking a progressive approach towards that. So what are the important things we need to really concentrate in on for our longevity? Strength training is huge. Cardiovascular training, continuous cardiovascular training, hugely important. But then also very high intensity interval training, hugely important. And then I think that power training or plyometric or jump training is massively underrated, but is inherently risky. Mm. And so we'll dig into some details on how we progress. But for me, the progressions look like going from higher rep ranges in the 12 to 15 reps because that's how we start to build some level of conditioning to the muscles. And we start learning these new movement patterns and re-educating the nervous system on how to coordinate those movement patterns in a relatively safe environment. The more load we apply to the body in terms of that absolute weight, the more likely we are to find that tissue whose capacity we will exceed. And especially as we start getting into more and more complex movements. So if I can do a 15 rep max, I'm probably not going to hurt myself, right? Because the absolute weight isn't all that much, but I'm still getting a huge stimulus on the muscle because I'm getting to the point where I probably couldn't lift a 16th rep, right? So we're getting close to failure. We start with these exercises that are fundamental to connecting through the core. And so we'll have an extensive core and hip training program. Then we'll start with movement patterns like the squat and the hinge patterns. So squatting, basically bending at the knee and the hip, just with a weight probably held at the chest in a goblet squat, and a hinge pattern where we keep the back straight, legs straight, and we just bend forward from the hips. Learning these fundamental patterns in a low weight, higher rep environment allows us and prepares us to move into some heavier weights where we might be going down to 6 to 8 to 12 reps, but with a heavier absolute weight. Now we start getting some of those more strength related benefits where we're increasing strength, we're increasing muscle mass, we're having a positive impact on body fat, as well as we're putting enough stress on the bones to start moving bone mineral density in the right direction. So that would be sort of a progression. And then once we've got to those higher rep ranges, now we start a whole new progression on our jump training. And so we start conditioning the muscles to move and contract with a bit more velocity. So we apply force first, get the muscle very strong. Strong people are harder to kill. And then we move into velocity, where now we've got strong muscles. Now we can teach them to contract quickly and progress from more of an eccentric loading or putting the brakes on, and then into more of a dynamic jump.
So what sort of time frame are we talking about? You know, how long does this take for my body to notice that something's different and then to have time to build things that give me some resilience that I can then do a little harder on top of?
Yeah, so if you look at basic physiological adaptation, it's way longer than we're being told on Instagram. The body adapts in about 6 to 8 weeks is where we will start adapting to the phase. So we'll have one program that we're on, might be 2-3 days a week, but we'll do that same program different on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, for example, for 8 weeks. And it will be that basic core level training program. And I tell people before they ever start working with me, about 8 weeks in, you're going to be starting to get irritated with me because I won't let you go off and do these more fun looking activities that you want to do. I tell people this whole transition is going to take 6, 9, 12 months, depending on where you're starting from.
Very long. So you have to have patience.
Oh, yes. We're playing the long game. This is longevity. This is not the 6 week abs program because you're going on vacation next week, right? This is a long-term program that is goal-based with the goal of avoiding frailty in older age.
But not get injured, right? Along the way.
Well, but that's avoiding frailty.
Okay.
Right. Injury is the number one risk factor for me in triggering the sequence of events that leads to all of these catastrophic injuries, the hip fractures, leads to all of the chronic diseases. Because we get hurt, every system downregulates when we undergo a period of rest or recovery from injury. If we then think we can jump right back to where we were, we exceed our capacity because we've dropped, and we get hurt again. And so now our capacity drops even more. So we become more and more frail, more and more sedentary, more and more withdrawn from our community. You know, your cycling club, your tennis club, where you're actually getting social connection. Now we start getting more exposure to metabolic disease, cardiovascular disease, and dementia. And so avoiding injury is our number one goal. And we do that through training for sport.
Okay, so that's really good. And some of this stuff I have done, you know, with cycling and even weight training, I've just been doing it a long time. And so I kind of have a sense of how to avoid that, you know, like in weight training that, you know, every time, everything that I do, every first set is a warm-up set where it's easy. I'm just going through the range of motion and, you know, and then if I feel something feels a little off, a little niggle, it's like, oh no, you know, today's not the day. And I just back off, you know, because I have made the mistakes. Oh, I could push through that. Oh, now I'm not doing military press for 3 months. Okay, great.
Right.
But the things that are the hardest for me, and anyway, if you have things to add to that, please do. But here's my question. The things that are the harder things for me are things that I really just don't have a ton of experience with. And that is some things that I've been adding in more recently, like sprint training. That I'll go down to this soccer playing area where they've got artificial turf with, you know, the little rubber bits. So it's a very springy surface and I'm wearing springy shoes on top of it.
Yeah.
So I'm not getting hard impacts. And I started by running around this thing. I'm probably running a mile, and then I went again and I would run a mile. And then like the third time I sprinted for 20 yards. And that felt really bad. And so, you know, then I went back and I sprinted for 50 yards. And then I started, you know, my hamstrings are tight and they stay tight for weeks afterwards. And I'm only doing it once a week. And it's like, well, I'm doing too much too fast and I don't know what I'm doing wrong. I don't know how to get back into where I can actually go sprinting once a week and not be injured from it. And so similarly, the box jumping thing.
You know,
if I jumped off a box and then jumped back up onto another box, I'm going right to the hospital. I have no idea how to not, you know, die of agony or an actual injury from these sudden shocky moves on my old knees. Yeah. So what is this progression on some of these more extreme modalities?
Yeah, so this is that second progression we're alluding to. Right. So we get strong and then we start building in the jump training. So the reason you're getting so sore, if you look at the ground reaction forces that are associated with these different movements, if you go walking is 1 to 3 times body weight going through your kinetic chain and coming back up through your kinetic chain with every step, depending on how fast you walk. The faster you go, you start getting more shock coming back up at you. You start jogging. Now we're getting sort of 4, 5, 6 times body weight. We start sprinting. We can start getting up into 8 times body weight per stride. Mm. So these are huge forces that are coming through the body. That force, as we plant down into the ground, is an eccentric contraction. So eccentric is like when we squat and we're lowering down. So the muscle's getting longer as it contracts. Great for the muscle, but causes huge amounts of soreness. Mm. So we have to condition the body to get it used to that kind of contraction. So we will start, as we're going into our plyometric phase, we will overemphasize that in the strength training. So we might change how we do our squat, for example. So instead of just down and up, we might take 3, 4 seconds to squat down. We might pause at the bottom, and then we might come back up. But we'll come up a little quicker. So we start teaching the body how to do that movement. Then we might progress into something where, like one of my fall prevention drills that I do with all of my clients is we'll actually stand up on your tiptoes, you fall forward, and then you bring your leg out in front and catch. And we'll actually do that for reps. So we'll do 5 or 6, up to 8 reps where we're catching. Then we might do what's called a snap down. So again, you stand up, your arms are overhead. So you look like you're about to drop down and jump back up, but you just snap down as quick as you can and you stop. You put the brakes on. So we're preparing these phases of the movement, and the next progression would be down and a vertical jump. So we come down quickly and then we jump as high as we can and we land. So it's a progression over weeks towards this jumping, and the same would be true for sprinting. You're absolutely right in that you went into jogging for distance, and then we started building in some shorter sprints. But what you did was you went from jogging to sprinting, even though it was 20 yards. So you'd look at, okay, what's the percentage of my maximum sprint speed? And so what we would do is you'd start off and it would be 70, 80%. And you'd do 20 yards for reps. And you'd progress the velocity. So you go, maybe next week, or after 3 weeks, you go up to 85, 90%. And then it would take us 6 weeks before we're actually sprinting 20 yards. Once we've gone through that progression, now we would extend the distance. Because as we extend the distance, we start getting into more longer strides. We start involving the hamstrings more. So now we've got to condition the hamstrings a little bit for longer distances. So it would be more tempo runs where we're at 60, 70%. We're faster than a jog, but we're just doing these strides and conditioning over time. And that's how we bring you back to more of a return to full sprinting over many weeks. and we're taking it easy on our hammies and we're listening to our body. But we should all be doing it. Everybody should be sprinting. But how we get there has to be very, very careful and very well planned out, because the most critical factor in any form of training is consistency. And if we lose 2 months because we tear a hamstring, now we're really compromised. And so we lose that consistency. So I'd rather you take longer and go a little bit slower and not get an injury, but be able to do it over many, many years in order to really maintain that trait.
Yeah, yeah. So that's absolutely right. I even knew that. It's just hard to do it, you know, on your own, especially if you're running with a dog and the dog is sort of running backwards and laughing at you.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're like, I can run faster. You know, I'm going to catch you. And no, you can't.
Joe, I'm only saying this because I'm telling you how to do it. Like, the biggest injuries I've had are ego injuries in the gym.
There you go. There you go.
Sure, I can add another 20 pounds to that. Yeah, I can sprint. I don't need a warm up, you know.
Oh, it's terrible. People, you can't trust them. Yeah. Okay. So this is really good. And the box jumps, how do you progress into the box jumps? I suppose I could get a little half inch tall box and jump off of it.
Yeah.
One thing that I've been doing that maybe isn't helping because I'm not getting deep, but I've done this thing called, in fact, you could just tell me this is stupid and I can stop, but it's called fascia bouncing, I think. Mm-hmm. And I just like stand on a little rubber mat and I spend like a minute just sort of bouncing up and down, my feet not leaving the ground.
Yeah.
And then after I've done that little bit of a warm up, now I'm jumping and I'm getting a full half inch off the ground, but I'm actually jumping off the ground and just sort of bouncing. It's not really, I'm not bending my knees much. It's just kind of bouncing, because the whole idea is that I'm just sort of just getting something going in there.
Yeah.
That's not really training me for box jumping, I don't think, because I'm not going very deep into like a squat kind of a thing. Yeah. But anyway, tell me how, if that's stupid, tell me, and what should I do on top of that, if that's not stupid, to help me to where I can do more of this eccentric type of training and get that big signal to my body to build some stronger muscles.
So what the fascial bouncing that you're doing, that's priming for the tendons, right? If you think about, like, ankle stiffness is one of the key markers of running fast. And that's because the structures around your ankle, your Achilles, is basically a big spring. So what you're doing by not bending and getting down into deep ranges and activating through the muscle, you're priming the tendons that are supposed to take that elastic load. So that's a great warm-up. I don't like box jumps for the longevity community, right? For the masters athlete. And the reason is because I've worked with some of the world's best basketball players. And I've seen guys with 40-inch vertical jumps catch their toe and scrape their shins down a 12-inch box. Because you can, right? Because it's just a momentary lapse. I've done it myself. You can catch your toe on a box and fall, break your wrists, you know, be embarrassed in the gym, all the rest of it. So I just think that there are better things for us to be worried about than trying to jump onto a 30-inch box.
Okay, now, good.
I still do it because of my ego.
There you go.
But the reason we would choose a box jump with an athlete is because it is a purely concentric movement. So we add them in to increase power, and we would put them particularly in season because we don't want them having the landing forces. So if I've got a guy with a 30-inch vertical jump, he jumps up and he lands on the ground from that height, and we do that repeatedly, that's a lot of impact forces on the body. In season, we're just trying to keep the nervous system awake. We're not trying to condition the body for that impact force. So we would specifically choose box jumps because they are purely concentric. You jump your 30 inches and you land, right? With no impact forces, basically. So understanding why we would choose them, and we use them for hockey a lot, because hockey is a purely concentric sport for the most part. Very little eccentric landing forces in ice hockey. So good for that reason. But whenever we're looking at a program, we must be able to say why an exercise is in our program. I always evaluate that against the risk of injuring someone. If one of my NBA players had got injured right before a game because I chose to do box jumps with them, that's not going to look great on me. Similarly, now I'm working with women in their 80s. Could I get them to jump on boxes? Sure, I could. Is it worth the risk of one of those women catching their toes and falling on their face? Like, absolutely not. So that's my soapbox, and I'm going to get absolutely killed for it, I'm sure. But that's the internet these days. So look, once we're over 40, our vertical jump just isn't that high. So we don't have to worry about the impact forces as much.
Yeah.
So I would just jump in the air, honestly. Like, so we just start with that vertical jump. So arms above the head, up on the toes, throw the arms down, drop as low, not as low as we can, but as fast as we can, and just jump up as high as we can, land, catch with good form, pause, reset, and just do that for reps. We don't need to worry about jumping onto a platform.
Okay.
The other thing is jumping for distance. Okay, how far can I jump? Same mechanics. Jump and jump forward as far as we can jump. Can we do skater jumps side to side? So jumping sideways from one leg to the other with a pause. We get balance. We get lateral movement. Can we do single leg vertical jumps once we get really good? All of these are progressions towards now. I do have one of my 83-year-old women jumping off a box. So she will now step off the box and catch, right? So similar to that snap down we talked about. Then we progressed to catch and jump. Mm. And then catch and jump forward for distance. But it's taken us 12 months, 13 months to get her there.
All right.
And we're talking about a box that's 12 inches high. We're not talking about she's jumping off a 40-inch box and doing plyos. I think that combined with some jump rope is so good. Like, jump rope was the activity I used to prevent Achilles injuries in the NBA.
Really?
It would be fine for your master's athlete who wants to prepare for basically anything. So we would warm up every day with jump rope, some hip exercises, and some dynamic stretching. And we didn't have any Achilles tears for four seasons in the NBA.
Gosh, jump ropes. That just sounds so simple. Wow.
Isn't it?
Yeah. I got to get a jump rope. Okay, so what about isometrics? Do you employ them? I had heard some time ago that isometrics were good for my tendons, that if I loaded them and kept them loaded for a while, then the weak spots in my tendons would get a stimulus to get stronger, whereas, you know, an acute, sudden thing, it would just sort of go around the weak spots and, you know, maybe I'd get a tear, maybe it would all just go. Right. But otherwise, I'm not really getting the stimulus on the weak spot of the tendon. What's true about that?
Yeah, I really like isometrics for tendons in particular. Again, we would use them in the NBA. We would use them in hockey. When someone would get like jumper's knee, the patella tendon would get really inflamed. Yeah. Tendons are really sensitive to that those spikes in training load. So if we suddenly start doing a lot of jumping, a lot of sprinting, we'll get Achilles will get really sore, our knee might get really sore. And so I'll use them a lot with clients. It's a great way to start out. So we've got one gentleman who's really just starting to get back after many years of not conditioning his body. So rather than starting with squats and lunges and all these things, we're actually doing wall sits, right? So he's just taking his thighs down to 90 degrees. He's leaning back against the wall, holding for 30 seconds. We start to fatigue out some of the muscle fibers in the quads, and we start to rely on that tendon. And so we put more force through the tendon, and it's a great evidence-based way to heal tendinopathies, to if you have tendinopathy, to reduce pain before you go for a run. So if you've got an Achilles tendinopathy, doing some heavy isometrics and really putting force through that Achilles will actually quiet it down a little bit so you can go and do your run.
That's interesting. So that,
yeah, applying them in various settings, I've found them to be a wonderful tool.
Great. And do you combine it with like collagen and things like that, or do you not worry about that?
Yeah, collagen's an interesting one. It's a super low quality protein, and we actually get all of the essential amino acids if we're taking enough protein in our diet. Now, having said that, I used it because why not, right? It's certainly not harming us. And yeah. There's some good evidence that if we take collagen with vitamin C about 30 to 40 minutes before we train the tendon, that we get some really positive adaptations. The reason you'd want to take it before is because tendons have really poor blood flow. And so we're just not delivering a lot of nutrients to them. That's why tendinopathies stick around for a long time. And so if we actually start exercising the tendon, we increase the blood flow, and we'll actually deliver some of those nutrients that we're now putting into the system. So we would use things like fish oil and collagen and some protein supplements in order to actually help our athletes heal.
Okay, and so we're not 100% sure it is helping, but it's not hurting, and it might help, so why not?
So why not? I would recommend using it. It won't replace the heavy isometrics. We tend to feel the pain, and we stop lifting. You need to be putting a stimulus onto the tendon to heal. Because what happens is, rather than having these beautiful aligned fibers, they get all knotted up and start going sort of all over the place.
I see you've met my fibers.
Yeah, right. So we need to remodel that tendon. And we can only do that with force, putting load through so that they will align in the direction of the force.
That makes sense.
We're thinking about just having like PRP and throwing collagen at it and all these different things. It's just going to stay in that mess. And you might get rid of a little bit of inflammation and pain for a while, but as soon as you start again, it's going to hurt again.
Yeah.
So nothing replaces just that heavy loading.
And so one last little bit on the isometrics. I've heard people complain about pain. It hurts. You know, my right knee's not good. And when I do an isometric, it hurts. Is that like a sign to not do it, or should I do it in a different way to lower the pain, or should I just push through the pain because that's going to make it stronger and then it won't hurt so much?
The old answer of it depends.
Yeah.
You know, if we're talking about tendons, right? If you feel that same symptomatic pain in the tendon that replicates the pain you've been having, you just sort of need to go through it. I don't want it to be a 10 out of 10 pain. I'd like you to be at more of a 3 out of 10, but I don't mind if you feel it. I want you to keep going for 30 to 45 seconds. I want you to do 3 sets. Mm-hmm. But if it's a pain that's sharper, pinching, stabbing, it's deeper into the knee joint, we want to be avoiding that and going and seeing a physical therapist for a really thorough evaluation. Imaging can be helpful, but I would rather have a real manual exam with an expert physical therapist just to see what's going on there. So there are certain pains we don't mind, and I would almost encourage, because we have to strengthen through that tendon, through that range. And so I don't want to be afraid and end up avoiding it, in which case it gets weaker and weaker and weaker, and we get more pain and more susceptible to injury. So some pain is okay. If it's pinching, if it's really sharp, that pain that sort of makes you jump, then I'd want to be avoiding that.
Yeah, yeah, and get a professional to help you with it.
Correct, yeah.
All right, good. So we've got about 10 minutes left here, and we've only talked about, you know, I think probably one of multiple pillars of your approach. You know, is there anything else that you would say is important for the older athlete to help in this progression and then maintenance of kind of a youthful functioning body? And I guess I'll just say one last thing, is that all of the stuff that we were talking about is probably things you should do before you go out and play pickleball as hard as you can the very first time. That way you don't blow something out or get so sore that you conclude this is the dumbest thing I ever did. Get your body ready for it. If you've been doing nothing, then you've got a lot of ground to catch up on. If you've been doing a lot, but like me, you've just been cycling and lifting weights, well, you're sort of like a couch potato when it comes to getting onto the pickleball court. So you got to get yourself ready for your sport before you go all out for that sort of thing. But there's more than just like lifting weights and cardiovascular activity and strengthening my tendons. What else is there?
Yeah, so there's a number of things. And I think what becomes more important are the traditional medical screenings. You know, being proactive and making sure that nothing's creeping up on us. As we get older, we're just more susceptible to disease creeping in, to cancers, to, you know, cardiovascular disease. And we can often think, because we're active and because we're doing all this stuff, that we're super healthy. And men especially will avoid these diagnostic tests. Doing regular cancer screening, depending on your level of resources, whatever your insurance will pay for if you don't have a ton of resources, go and get your colonoscopies, go and get all of your cancer screens, go and get your blood work done. Ask your doctor for these more advanced blood work panels that can give you an indication of your risk of Alzheimer's, that can, you know, things like ApoB that are causally correlated to atherosclerotic plaque buildup. Mm-hmm. We need to know, we can know what's going on inside our body, and so we should. A lot of people will avoid it because it's scary to find out. And, you know, especially with the cancer screening, I don't want to know. Mm-hmm. It's the wrong way to look at it. It's, when do you want to know? You're going to find out. Do you want to know now where you can do something about it? Or do you want to know down the line when it's too late?
Yeah.
And that's a mindset that we need to start getting into with all of this stuff around our medical wellness as we age. But also probably the most underrated factor is our community. And I said it at the start, that's why we want people to continue their sport largely, is because it's probably the best predictor of longevity, is do you have real meaningful relationships? And if you're removed from your tennis club all of a sudden, mental health, stress, all of these inflammatory markers all go through the roof, leaving you way more susceptible to disease. So being around family, around really close friends, and really working on those bonds, for me, that those are some of the most important parts of our longevity program that aren't talked about, and they're not very profitable. You know, I can't put that on my website and sell it to you at a great profit. Right, so you don't hear many people talking about it, but it's just critical. You know, and we talk about things like sleep, you know, just the competition for your attention these days. Like, Instagram don't make any money when you're asleep. They don't want you to sleep. But the cascade of negative impacts from not sleeping are just catastrophic. But, you know, particularly in the United States and in the UK to a certain extent, it's sort of demonized. Like you're lazy if you're getting 9 hours of sleep, right? Can you imagine like these guys showing up to their high powered jobs like, oh yeah, I got 10 hours of sleep last night. They'd be embarrassed.
Yes. Right? Sleep when you're dead, that's what they always said.
Oh my God. Well, sooner rather than later it'll be.
Yeah.
You know, it's just so important to think about these health promoting lifestyle factors. We've not even mentioned diet. But, you know, are we eating enough protein? Are we getting enough fiber? Are we keeping our calories in check? Again, enough. Not we're not on a diet 24/7, but we're getting enough calories. We're not overeating. You know, we're staying in energy balance. We're getting our protein. We're getting our fiber to promote a healthy microbiome. Your microbiome is going to dictate most of the rest of your health, including your mental health, amazingly enough. So, you know, these are all just they're fascinating factors that I don't think get enough attention, but they should.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's good advice and fair. Tell us about your business. You work with, I guess, anybody, but talk about how you work with Older Eth.
Yeah, so it's been a really interesting evolution coming out of sport. And we built these models to protect the athlete. No, I'm not going to say protect them. We wanted to have them not get injured and perform optimally. Mm-hmm. And so it was a multidisciplinary department that we built from medical all the way through like advanced material science and data analysis and strength conditioning, rehab, everyone working together. And then, so when we came out of sport and looked at healthcare, we just thought, well, this just sucks. Like we need to do for everybody what was being done in sport. So our mission is to change healthcare.
Great.
We need it to go from reactive to proactive. And so a lot of people are coming to me now who we're actually getting more people on the reactive side. They've been either in chronic pain in a some sort of state of sickness or injury, and the sort of traditional system has spat them out because they can't really figure out what to do with them. So I get a lot of these very complex cases to rehab and get back to performing, which I find immensely rewarding. And so, yeah, people come who want to keep going. They want to keep skiing and being with their families and going on trips with their friends where they can go and play tennis and take cycling tours of Greece and all these different things. So
love it.
So that we're now applying that model to help people really live out their years as fully as they possibly can.
Well, that sounds great. How do we find you?
Yeah, so we are on Instagram, LinkedIn, YouTube at Vitality Collective Performance. We have our podcast, which is the Vitality Collective Podcast.
Great.
And we interview experts from my past in sport and try and bring as high quality knowledge as we can and transmit it in a way that's clean, understandable, and you can apply into your life right away. Like we're not getting into mitochondrial physiology because it typically doesn't mean anything. We're talking about eat fiber, right? So really practical, really usable advice. So come and check us out on there and you know, feel free to communicate with us anyway through any of those channels. Our website is vitality-collective.com. And so, yeah, there's lots of ways to get in touch and we love chatting about this stuff. So happy to chat with anyone.
And so you're in the Fort Myers, Florida area, but you work like telehealth. I mean, you're like a virtual health provider.
Yeah. So we have basically everything we do now is virtual. And so from our strength conditioning program, our virtual training that we do online with our clients twice a week to, you know, we review medical files and all this sort of stuff. And we can coordinate with people's providers and it's all remote. So we've got people in LA, Denver, Santa Barbara, in California, we're up in Boston. So we're all over the country.
Fantastic. Well, Jeremy, hey, thank you very much. I appreciate that. I'll check your podcast out. I listened to you on somebody else's podcast a couple of times, and that's how I came to know about you. So, hey, thanks for all the work that you're doing for free and throwing it out there for people like me.
Joe, it's an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, yeah, I enjoyed it. Thanks a bunch. Have a good one.
You too.
All right, bye-bye. Thank you so much for joining my conversation with Jeremy Bettel. You can find more information about him and the Vitality Collective in the show notes.